You're listening to The Bookshelf on Spokane Public Radio. I'm bookshelf volunteer Annie Mattson, and tonight we return to Sherlock Holmes and the Musgrave Ritual by Arthur Conan Doyle. Since this case took place before Watson teamed up with Sherlock, it is told largely from Sherlock's perspective. The case centers on the strange behavior and consequent disappearance of the Musgrave family's butler, Brunton, from their home at the Hurlston Estate. Before he vanished, Brunton was caught with an old family document detailing what is known as the Musgrave Ritual, a series of obscure questions and answers that have been passed down through generations. Thinking that the mystery of the Musgrave Ritual and the mystery of the missing butler are somehow related, Sherlock continues his investigation. Here's Lucas Vanderwald reading the second half of the Musgrave Ritual.
The same afternoon saw us both at Hurlston. Possibly if you have seen pictures and read descriptions of the famous old building, so I will confine my account of it to saying that it is built in the shape of an L, the long arm being the more modern portion and the shorter the ancient nucleus from which the other had developed. Over the low, heavily lintelled door in the centre of this old part is chiselled the date, 1607, but experts are agreed that the beams and stonework are really much older than this. The enormously thick walls and tiny windows of this part had in the last century driven the family into building the new wing, and the old one was now used as a storehouse and a cellar, when it was used at all. A splendid park with fine old timber surrounds the house, and the lake, to which my client had referred, lay close to the avenue about 200 yards from the building. I was already firmly convinced, Watson, that there were not three separate mysteries here, but one only, and that if I could read the Musgrave Ritual aright, I should hold in my hand the clue which would lead me to the truth concerning both the butler Brunton and the maid Howells. To that, then, I turned all my energies. Why should this servant be so anxious to master this old formula? Evidently because he saw something in it which had escaped all those generations of country squires, and from which he expected some personal advantage. What was it, then? And how had it affected his fate? It was perfectly obvious to me on reading the ritual that the measurements must refer to some spot to which the rest of the document alluded, and that if we could find that spot, we should be in a fair way towards finding what the secret was which the old Musgraves had thought it necessary to embalm in so curious a fashion. There were two guides given us to start with, an oak and an elm. As to the oak, there could be no question at all. Right in front of the house, upon the left-hand side of the drive, there stood a patriarch among oaks, one of the most magnificent trees that I have ever seen. "That was there when your ritual was drawn up," said I as we drove past it. "It was there, the Norman Conquest, in all probability," he answered. "It has a girth of 23 feet. Here was one of my fixed points secured. "Have you any old elms?" I asked. "There used to be a very old one over yonder, but it was struck by lightning 10 years ago, and we cut down the stump." "You can see where it used to be?" "Oh, yes." "There are no other elms?" "No old ones, but plenty of beeches." "I should like to see where it grew." We had driven up in a dog cart, and my client led me away at once, without our entering the house, to the scar on the lawn where the elm had stood. It was nearly midway between the oak and the house. My investigation seemed to be progressing. "I suppose it is impossible to find out how high the elm was," I asked. "I can give it to you at once. It was 64 feet. "How do you come to know it?" I asked in some surprise. "When my old tutor used to give me an exercise in trigonometry, it always took the shape of measuring heights. When I was a lad, I worked out every tree and building in the estate." This was an unexpected piece of luck. My data were coming in more quickly than I could have reasonably hoped. "Tell me," I asked, "did your butler ever ask you such a question?" Reginald Musgrave looked at me in astonishment. "Now that you call it to my mind," he answered, "Brunton did ask me about the height of the tree some months ago, in connection with some little argument with the groom." This was excellent news, Watson, for it showed me that I was on the right road. I looked up at the sun. It was low in the heavens, and I calculated that in less than an hour it would lie just above the topmost branches of the old oak. One condition mentioned in the ritual would then be fulfilled, and the shadow of the elm must mean the farther end of the shadow, otherwise the trunk would have been chosen as the guide. I had then to find where the far end of the shadow would fall when the sun was just clear of the oak. Well, that must have been difficult, Holmes, when the elm was no longer there. Well, at least I knew that if Brunton could do it, I could also. Besides, there was no real difficulty. I went with Musgrave to his study and whittled myself this peg, to which I tied this long string with a knot at each yard. Then I took two lengths of a fishing rod, which came to just 6 feet, and I went back with my client to where the elm had been. The sun was just grazing the top of the oak. I fastened the rod end to end, marked out the direction of the shadow, and measured it. It was 9 feet in length. Of course, the calculation now was a simple one. If a rod of 6 feet threw a shadow of 9, a tree of 64 feet would throw one of 96, and the line of the one would, of course, be the line of the other. I measured out the distance, which brought me almost to the wall of the house, and I thrust the peg into the spot. You can imagine my exultation, Watson, when within 2 inches of my peg, I saw a conical depression in the ground. I knew that this was the mark made by Brunton in his measurements, and that I was still upon his trail. From this starting point, I proceeded to step, having first taken the cardinal points by my pocket compass. 10 steps with each foot took me along parallel with the wall of the house, and again I marked my spot with a peg. Then I carefully paced off 5 to the east and 2 to the south. It brought me to the very threshold of the old door. 2 steps to the west meant now that I was to go 2 paces down the stone flagged passage, and this was the place indicated by the ritual. Never have I felt such a cold chill of disappointment, Watson. For a moment it seems to me that there must be some radical mistake in my calculations. The setting sun shone full upon the passage floor, and I could see that the old foot-worn grey stones with which it was paved were firmly cemented together, and had certainly not been moved for many a long year. Brunton had not been at work here. I tapped upon the floor, but it sounded the same all over, and there was no sign of any crack or crevice. But fortunately, Musgrave, who had begun to appreciate the meaning of my proceedings, and who was now as excited as myself, took out his manuscript to check my calculation. "And under," he cried, "you have omitted the and under." I had thought that it meant that we were to dig, but now, of course, I saw at once that I was wrong. "There is a cellar under this, then?" I cried. "Yes, and as old as a house, down here, through this door." We went down a winding stone stair, and my companion, striking a match, lit a large lantern which stood on a barrel in the corner. In an instant, it was obvious that we had at last come upon the true place, and that we had not been the only people to visit the spot recently. It had been used for the storage of wood, but the billets, which had evidently been littered over the floor, were now piled at the sides so as to leave a clear space in the middle. In this space lay a large and heavy flagstone with a rusted iron ring in the centre, to which a thick shepherd's check muffler was attached. "By Jove!" cried my client. "That's Brunton's muffler. I have seen it on him and could swear to it. What has the villain been doing here?" At my suggestion, a couple of the county police were summoned to be present, and I then endeavoured to raise the stone by pulling on the cravat. I could only move it slightly, and it was with the aid of one of the constables that I succeeded at last in carrying it to one side. A black hole yawned beneath, into which we all peered, while Musgrave, kneeling at the side, pushed down the lantern. A small chamber, about 7 feet deep and 4 feet square, lay open to us. At one side of this was a squat, brass-bound wooden box, the lid of which was hinged upwards, with this curious old-fashioned key projecting from the lock. It was furred outside by a thick layer of dust and damp, and worms had eaten through the wood, so that a crop of livid fungi was growing on the inside of it. Several discs of metal, old coins apparently, such as I hold here, were scattered over the bottom of the box, but it contained nothing else. At the moment, however, we had no thought for the old chest, for our eyes were riveted upon that which crouched beside it. It was the figure of a man, clad in a suit of black, who squatted down upon his hams, with his forehead sunk upon the edge of the box and his two arms thrown out on each side of it. The attitude had drawn all the stagnant blood to the face, and no man could have recognized that distorted, liver-colored countenance. But his height, his dress, and his hair were all sufficient to show my client, when we had drawn the body up, that it was indeed his missing butler. He had been dead some days, but there was no wound or bruise upon his person to show how he had met his dreadful end. When his body had been carried from the cellar, we found ourselves still confronted with a problem which was almost as formidable as that with which we had started. I confess that so far, Watson, I had been disappointed in my investigation. I had reckoned upon solving the matter when once I had found the place referred to in the ritual. But now I was there, and was apparently as far as ever from knowing what it was which the family had concealed with such elaborate precautions. It is true that I had thrown a light upon the fate of Brunton, but now I had to ascertain how that fate had come upon him, and what part had been played in the matter by the woman who had disappeared. I sat down upon a keg in the corner and thought the whole matter carefully over. You know my methods in such cases, Watson. I put myself in the man's place, and having first gauged his intelligence, I tried to imagine how I myself should have proceeded under the same circumstances. In this case, the matter was simplified by Brunton's intelligence being quite first rate, so that it was unnecessary to make any allowance for the personal equation, as the astronomers have dubbed it. He knew that something valuable was concealed. He had spotted the place. He found that the stone which covered it was just too heavy for a man to move unaided. What would he do next? He could not get help from outside, even if he had someone whom he could trust without the unbarring of doors and considerable risk of detection. It was better, if he could, to have his helpmate inside the house. But whom could he ask? This girl had been devoted to him. A man always finds it hard to realize that he may have finally lost a woman's love, however badly he may have treated her. He would try by a few attentions to make his peace with the girl Howells, and then would engage her as his accomplice. Together, they would come at night to the cellar, and their unified force would suffice to raise the stone. So far, I could follow their actions as if I had actually seen them. But for two of them, and one, a woman, it must have been heavy work, the raising of that stone. A burly Sussex policeman and I had found it no light job. What would they do to assist them? Probably what I should have done myself. I rose and examined carefully the different billets of wood which were scattered round the floor. Almost at once I came upon what I expected. One piece, about 3 feet in length, had a very marked indentation at one end, while several were flattened at the sides, as if they had been compressed by some considerable weight. Evidently, as they had dragged the stone up, they had thrust the chunks of wood into the chink, until at last, when the opening was large enough to crawl through, they would hold it open by a billet placed lengthwise, which might very well become indented at the lower end, since the whole weight of the stone would press it down onto the edge of this other slab. So far, I was still on safe ground. And now, how was I to proceed to reconstruct this midnight drama? Clearly, only one could fit into the hole, and that was Brunton. The girl must have waited above. Brunton then unlocked the box, handed up the contents, presumably, since they were not to be found, and then what happened? What smouldering fire of vengeance had suddenly sprung into flame in this passionate Celtic woman's soul when she saw the man who had wronged her perhaps far more than we suspected, in her power? Was it a chance that the wood had slipped and that the stone had shut Brunton into what had become his sepulchre? Had she only been guilty of silence as to his fate? Or had some sudden blow from her hand dashed the support away and sent the slab crashing down into its place? Be that as it might, I seemed to see that woman's figure still clutching at her treasure trove and flying wildly up the winding stair, with her ears ringing perhaps with the muffled screams from behind her, and with the drumming of frenzied hands against the slab of stone which was choking her faithless lover's life out. Here was the secret of her blanched face, her shaken nerves, her peals of hysterical laughter on the next morning. But what had been in the box? What had she done with that? Of course, it must have been that old metal and pebbles which my client had dragged from the mere. She had thrown them in there at the first opportunity to remove the last trace of her crime. For 20 minutes, I had sat motionless, thinking the matter out. Musgrave still stood with a very pale face, swinging his lantern and peering down into the hole. "These are coins of Charles the First," said he, holding out the few which had been in the box. "You see, we were right in fixing our date for the ritual." "We may find something else of Charles the First," I cried, as the probable meaning of the first two questions of the ritual suddenly broke upon me. "Let me see the contents of the bag which you fished from the mere." We ascended to his study, and he laid the debris before me. I could understand his regarding it as of small importance when I looked at it, for the metal was almost black, and the stones lusterless and dull. I rubbed one of them on my sleeve, however, and it glowed afterwards like a spark in the dark hollow of my hand. The metalwork was in the form of a double ring, but it had been bent and twisted out of its original shape. "You must bear in mind," said I, "that the royal party made head in England even after the death of the king, and that when they at last fled, they probably left many of their most precious possessions buried behind them with the intention of returning for them in more peaceful times. My ancestor, Sir Ralph Musgrave, was a prominent cavalier and the right-hand man of Charles II in his wanderings," said my friend. "Ah, indeed," I answered. "Well, now, I think that really should give us the last link that we wanted. I must congratulate you into coming into possession, though in a rather tragic manner, of a relic which is of great intrinsic value, but of even greater importance as a historical curiosity." "What is it, then?" he gasped in astonishment. "It is nothing less than the ancient crown of the kings of England."
"The crown?"
"Precisely. Consider what the ritual says. How does it run? Whose was it? His who is gone. That was after the execution of Charles. Then, who shall have it? He who will come. That was Charles II, whose advent was already foreseen. There can, I think, be no doubt that this battered and shapeless diadem once encircled the brows of the royal Stuarts."
"And how came it in the pond?"
"Ah, that is a question that will take some time to answer." And with that, I sketched out to him the whole long chain of surmise and of proof which I had constructed. The twilight had closed in and the moon was shining brightly in the sky before my narrative was finished.
"And how was it then that Charles did not get his crown when he returned?"
asked Musgrave, pushing back the relic into its linen bag.
"Ah, there you lay your finger upon the one point which we shall probably never be able to clear up. It is likely that the Musgrave who held the secret died in the interval and by some oversight left this guide to his descendant without explaining the meaning of it. From that day to this, it has been handed down from father to son until at last it came within reach of a man who tore its secret out of it and lost his life in the venture. That's the story of the Musgrave ritual, Watson. They have the crown down at Hurlstone, though they had some legal bother and a considerable sum to pay before they were allowed to retain it. I'm sure that if you mention my name, they will be happy to show it to you. Of the woman, nothing was ever heard, and the probability is that she got away out of England and carried herself and the memory of her crime to some land beyond the seas.
That was Sherlock Holmes and the Musgrave Ritual by Arthur Conan Doyle, read for the Bookshelf by Lucas Vanderwald. If you'd like to listen back to this, or to any other past episodes of the Bookshelf, you can find them online at SpokanePublicRadio.org or by searching for the Bookshelf Podcast on Google Play or Apple Podcasts. This episode of the Bookshelf was produced by Chris Massini and me, Annie Mattson. The executive producer of the Bookshelf is Vern Windham. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.